Okay. So I just got done telling you about the magic of the internet protocol and how we use these numbers to move data across the world to computers on networks that are far, far away without overwhelming the network. Unfortunately, those numbers are nasty. They're just really hard for humans. When I first started using the internet, I used to have post-it notes on my computer with things like Minnesota and then a number, right? We'd remember them. But that was a long time ago. Facebook is like a bunch of numbers. So we had to come up with a way to make some human readable. And the problem is the web server for Michigan might be on North Campus one year and then it'll be on Main Campus another year. And we don't want, and if you change from North Campus to Main Campus, the number is likely to change. So they get reorganized, they get moved, so we need to come up with some kind of a shorthand. And as Vince said, this was something that John Postel did. And so we came up with these human readable names. And so the IP addresses read from left to right like a phone number, where the left prefix is basically geographical, and then the closer you get, the more detailed. If you look at a post office address, it kind of goes from left to right, where Earth is the most big thing, or galaxy maybe, Earth, USA, zip code, Michigan, actually Michigan would be over here, but Ann Arbor, North Quad, and then the room that we're in, right? The same is true about the domain names. Edu, UMich, SI, www. So Edu is all educational institutions, UMich is a particular one. SI is School of Information, and WW is one of the servers inside that. Now, what they figured out early on was they couldn't control every single name. They wanted to have sort of as simple a possible structure at the middle, at the center of it, and to delegate the organization of this out as far as possible to make it scalable. If they made it so every time we wanted to add a server at the School of Information, we had to call the government in Washington, D.C., it would take forever and no one would ever get servers put in. So they wanted to delegate it. So they started with these top-level domain spaces like .org for organizations, edu for educational institutions, com for commercials, and then they later add like NL for Netherlands and JP for Japan. So these top-level things. Now the key is that these are owned. Some things like com and org are owned in kind of the public good, where you can go get any .com you want. As long as you're first there and it's not a trademark violation, you can have it. But edu is different. Edu is given to an organization called EduCause, and they have conferences and all kinds of things. But one of the things they do is they decide who gets edu domain names. So when Michigan wanted an edu domain name, we would go and apply to these folks. And we'd say, could we have umich.edu? And they go like, are you a university? Yes. Is UMich kind of a good name for it? That sounds good. No one else seems to want that. You can have it. And like if I wanted like drchuck.edu, I could go and I could ask them, could I have drchuck.edu? Which to me seems like a completely reasonable thing. But they might not think that because they own it. And they'll say, no, you can't have drchuck.edu. So the same thing happens for at Michigan. So we say ctools.umich.edu. In 2004, the name of that server was like ctools.dmc.itd.umich.edu. It was like that long. And then we went to the committee that is umich.edu and we said, could we please have ctools? And they're like, let's think. Could that be confused with something? Might there be another ctools that's something else? Might we have a department ever named this Department of ctools? And they thought for a couple of months and they said, yea, verily, you can have ctools.umich.edu. I could ask for drchuck.umich.edu. And they would likely say, no, it wouldn't take very long at all for that. So the School of Information would go to that committee that owns the umich.edu and say, you know, we'd like siumich.edu. And they might say, well, let me think about that. And they finally say, okay, there you go. Yeah.
The UMich committee, is it part of the University of Michigan?
It is. Okay. It is. It's really humans.
So that level it's, is here.
Yep. It's humans, and they meet in a room somewhere on this campus, and you send them a proposal that says, we'd like ctools. And then they meet.
the .edu level is higher.
Yep, and it's an organization, but it's still, at some point, there's humans in a room. Now, that those people probably flew into that room for EDUCAUSE, but it indeed is humans in a room. So SI got siumich.edu. So then I could ask them, can I have drchuck.si.umich.edu? That's a committee as well. It's just getting, the committees are getting smaller now. and they go, no, you can't have drchuck.si.umich.edu. Committee has verily decided you cannot. We have a thing called people.si.umich.edu because we don't want you to sort of like be confused with something else that we're doing. So you can be under people.si.umich.edu. And so I said, could I become drchuck.people.si.umich.edu? And they go, no, you cannot, because we have a policy that the only thing you can put after people.si.umich.edu is csev. So you can be csev.people.si.umich.edu. So if you go there, you direct right back, it gives a redirect to drchuck.com. But the point is there's like ownership. And if any of you want like something.drchuck.com, I can sell it to you. Because that's really valuable, I'm sure, right? Because I own drchuck.com, which means I can make things below it to my heart's content. So far, it has not been a great source of income for me. I don't quite understand why. But whatever spot you own it kind of from there down. And so there's all this ownership. And so that's the domain name. And there's a bunch of tricky stuff that makes it so that you can look these things up and get IP addresses. The communication, the data, is all going back and forth to IP addresses. So we just finished this IP layer. And now we're going to move up to the next layer. Vint mentioned that at some point IP and TCP got split because they had more complex kinds of networks underneath of it. And that was great because it really saved us. So the TCP lives above IP, and its job, as Vint said, is reliable end-to-end with retransmission if necessary. That's its primary purpose. So we got somewhere between here and Stanford, there's like 16 hops. Things might fail. And IP keeps good and bad paths, but there's no guarantee of delivery. Things can go bad. And we try to make it as fast as possible, as simple as possible, but not try to do everything. So TCP ends up being kind of simple by the time it's all said and done, even though it's got probably 10,000 engineers that worked on it. The concept is really simple. Your computer, when it sends data across the network, it keeps a copy of it. It keeps a copy of it until it gets an acknowledgement from the far side. And if it takes too long, it sends it again. This is kind of what's happening when you're watching YouTube and it says buffering. Right, it's like, well, I'm waiting for something. Not coming yet. I'll wait a while. Okay, I'll ask for it again. So there's this retry. So here's how it works. You take a message, and sorry if the numbers are different. Their numbers are actually byte offsets rather than packet offsets. So these are blocks of 100 character packets. So there's the first 100, the second 100, the third 100, and the fourth 100 character packets. And your computer has a message. It's 500 long. And the computer basically says, I'm going to send some data. I want to send it all. But it doesn't actually send all of it. It has what's called a window size. The packets go one after another as they leave your computer. So the first one goes out of your computer. The second one goes out of your computer. Third one goes out of your computer. Because they're going to have to go across like 16 hops, if you only sent one, it might be a quarter of a second to get to Stanford. Then acknowledgement gets back. But you could send like three and they would chase each other back. They chase each other across. And you get three times as much data across. And then you get one acknowledgement. So you sort of optimistically send some data. You get ahead. Then you wait. So you send and then you wait. So packets 100 and 300, everything in this class with a 2 in it seems to be snake bit. So packet 200 burns up in Kansas City. Time passes. The receiver goes, doesn't look like I'm getting anything else. And so it sends a note back that says, you know, I've been sitting here for a while. We're not done yet. I would know if we were done. I've got 100, and why don't you start over at 200? Why don't you go back and start over at 200? As a matter of fact, it pretty much throws away the 300, but the sender can mark the 100 as received. And then it can sort of like start and send 200 and 300 again. This time 200 makes it, and shortly thereafter 300 makes it. Oh, no, it takes a while. So the receiver says, I got 200. Then the sender can mark that. 300 makes it. 400 makes it shortly thereafter. And it start, your sender starts throwing the packets away that it knows have been received. Now, it's going to say, it never said got 300 because 400 came so quick. So it says, I got 400. So the sender says, well, I know that 300 is good too now. So then it says, I'll send you 500. And then the sender starts throwing stuff away, and the receiver finally says, got 500. And they kind of also tell each other that they're done. And then the data has been sent. But the basic idea is the your sending computer, then that means your laptop is holding on to every bit of data it sends across TCP until Stanford or Facebook or whatever has acknowledged that data. Now, this turns out to be one of the most brilliant design decisions in the whole internet, in that if you think about it, especially with all the devices we carry in our pockets, there are literally billions of computers on the outside. There's a lot of routers in the middle, hundreds of thousands. But if we required each of the routers to store every packet in case it would get lost, it would take so much memory in the middle that these things would be slow. So we make the middle part really simple. Network numbers, packets, very few, throw them away. And then the storage to ensure the reliability. Every time we add another computer to the network, it has its own storage to help do the reliability. So that's a key. This retransmission and storage is end to end, not in the middle. The middle either delivers it or it dies. So I mentioned that TCP is simple. Well, there is indeed some engineering that could happen. So we're going to meet another person. His name is Van Jacobsen. He was a faculty member at Berkeley when all this happened. And he's a pretty shy guy, and he doesn't believe that he should be famous. But there's this part of the TCP part that we call the Van Jacobsen Protocol. Everyone except Van Jacobsen calls it the Van Jacobsen Protocol. He doesn't call it the Van Jacobsen. He calls it the slow start algorithm, but we all call it the Van Jacobsen Protocol. And the reason is in 85 and 86, we started putting the NSFNet up. And it turned out that there were people that thought that TCP/IP was a bad idea. It was IBM who had their own network and Digital that had their own network. And they said, all these hippies from California that made this network, it couldn't possibly work. You should use something from a really sweet, awesome company like us. So you should make DEC or IBM run the whole internet. It should all just be IBM equipment because we're professionals and we know how to do this. But we said, no, we're going to put this thing up. So we put this thing up, and shortly after it came up, it started crashing, which would prove the point of IBM and Digital, that somehow the hippies can't build something. And this is how I felt as I'm watching this happen here in the state of Michigan, not being part of what's going on as the building. And so I'm sitting here in Michigan, the thing's coming up, and we're having a great time, and it's like really cool, and then it crashes. I mean, literally, the whole internet kind of crashed, basically. And then, like, word came out that this guy, Van Jacobsen, had made this thing, and we'd applied patches to all the computers, and the internet started working again. I'm like, hallelujah! And then sort of from that point forward, the internet kind of has never crashed ever since, right? There's never been kind of a bug in the low-level protocols of the internet so bad that the whole thing, like, crapped out, right? The whole internet crapped out. So we think of him as, like, the savior of it all. And he's like, well, I was just hacking up some code. So let's meet the guy that I think saved us all, but he just thinks he was kind of a fun engineer having a good, oops, not Vint, we met Vint already. Van. Xerox PARC is just above Stanford. They invented the mouse.
They were lots of campus Ethernets because they were really easy to deploy, and you could put them in a department. then you could run a wire between two departments and you need a bigger network. And so we've grown up networks sort of by agglomeration in lots of different university campuses. And NSF came up with some money, said, oh, got a little bit in our budget where we could get some 56 kilobit lines and tie those campuses together. And they did that, the NSF had phase one. But now you're tying together 10 megabit campus infrastructure with 56 kilobit wires. And it was wildly popular because people that couldn't talk could suddenly talk. And they're sending emails and moving huge files, and everybody's really excited about this technology. But any one of those campuses could oversubscribe the net by a factor of 1,000. So we had a lot of packets piling up and getting dropped. At the time, I was a researcher at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, which is in the hills up above the Berkeley campus. And I was also teaching on the Berkeley campus, even back in those days, which was mid-80s, we had a, for the class, there was a messages group, you know, like a little news group that was set up. All the assignments would be put online. And I was trying to get course materials from my office in LBL down to a machine in Evans Hall at Berkeley, and there was like zero throughput in the net. It was one packet every 10 minutes or so, and it seemed unbelievably bad. And I went down and talked to Mike Carrolls, who was heading the BSD group, the people that develop Berkeley Unix, and he's giving reports of these problems from all over the country. From in those days, the easiest way to start running TCPIP was to bring up Berkeley Unix, because there was a ARPA-funded, very nice implementation in it. And everybody was seeing poor performance. So we talked for a long time that day and on succeeding days about, well, what's going on? Is there some mistake in the protocol implementation? Is there some mistake in the protocol? This thing was working on smaller scale tests and then it suddenly fell apart. I think we struggled for 3 or 4 months just going through the code, writing tools to capture packet traces and looking at the packet traces and trying to sort out what's breaking. And I remember the two of us were sitting in Mike's office after we'd been pounding our head against the wall for literally months. And one of us, I can't remember which one, said, you know, the reason I can't figure out why it's breaking is I don't understand how it ever worked. You know, we're sending these bits out at 10 megabits. They're zipping across campus. They're running into this 56 kilobit wire. We expect them to go through that wire, pop out on the other side, go through. How could that function? That turned out to be the crucial starting point. That at that point, we started saying, well, what is there about this protocol that makes it work? How does it deal with all of those bandwidth changes? How does it deal with the multiple hops? So this picture, that direction is time, this direction is bandwidth. So that's a fat pipe, but it's a skinny pipe. And the scale of the time is, you know, this is a 10 megabit pipe and this is a 56 kilobit pipe. So here the difference is about 3 to 1. It was really close to 100 to 1. And so time, seconds times bits per second equals bits. So each of these little boxes in there is a packet. It's the number of bits in a packet. And if you scrunch it down in bandwidth, it's got to spread out in time because the number of bits doesn't change. And so, see the burst of packets and then those worth of packets gets launched. It's going to fly through the net until it hits this fast to slow transition. And then, because the packets have to stretch out in time, they'll have to sit there and wait as they're fed into the slower wire. And you, they pop out the other side, they get spread out by this bottleneck, by the slower wire. Once they're spread out, they stay spread out. And there's nothing to push them back together again. They hit a receiver, it turns every data packet into an ACK. So you've got a bunch of ACKs that are going back towards the sender, and they remember what's the right spacing for that bottleneck. So the ACKs get back to the sender, and every ACK gets turned into a data packet. So you can see the data packets flying back. And this is after one round trip time. Now the packets are coming out perfectly spaced, so they go by, a new one goes into the net in exactly the time it takes a packet to exit from the bottleneck. So these ACKs are sort of acting as a clock that tells the sender when it's safe to inject every new packet. And they're always going to be spaced by whatever is the slowest point in the net.
And the key thing is how can you get the steady state sort of most quickly without wasting?
The issue that Feller we saw was this works perfectly after you've exchanged a round trip time worth of packets. But when you're starting up, when you're here, there's no clock. And so the hard part on TCP is not getting it running, it's getting it started. Because once you've got it running, you've got a clock that tells you exactly what to do. So if you turn them on suddenly, you get in this repetitive failure mode where you saturate the buffer that was available at some gateway. And then when you retransmit, you do the same thing again. So you're always losing packets. But if you turned it on more gradually, then you wouldn't overload the buffering and you'd get enough of a clock going so that you control the amount of backlog to fit the available buffer, but you'd still be growing the number of packets in flight so that you'd eventually get you start with a kind of sporadic clock, but you'd eventually fill in the details and get it for packet clock.
How did you get it to the point where it was in all the TCP/IP implementations on the planet? Because they kind of have to cooperate in a way.
So remember, it was a much simpler time when you're talking about all the TCP/IP implementations on the planet. At that time, there were like four. So there was the Berkeley Unix one, there was the MIT PCTCP, there was a BBN one that was used in butterflies and IMPs, and there was a Multics one. I took the couple of TCP kernel modules that we've been working on, packaged them up in a tar. I had this horrible driver hack that would let us snort packets from the kernel, and it was really a horrible driver hack. It was the way you said what you wanted to snort was by ADBing the kernel. You wrote in binary some new values. These are the ports that I want to look at, and the driver would capture those into a circular buffer, and you'd read kernel memory to pull that buffer out. Craig Larris and Chris Torek, who were working in a group at LBL and were both longtime kernel hackers, were just embarrassed at this, and they put together a really nice clean driver, they call BPF, the Berkeley packet filter, that would let you pull packets out of the kernel by a very efficient IO control interface. And so we bundled all of that up, and on the TCP/IP mailing list, which in those days was, TCP/IP was very experimental, it was very leading edge, and pretty much everybody who was playing with it was on that mailing list. So now that this stuff was available, a bunch of people FTP'd it, tried it, it blew up, sent kernel core dumps and bug reports, and fixed the bug reports, and put new versions out. somebody would immediately come back and say, panic here, you want the KCOR? And you go, oh, no, embarrassed. Put out a new version, go out. Somebody else would come back and say, panic here, and fix that, and just cycled like that. And after about a day, we got a version that didn't immediately panic, and then started working on the actual algorithms and a little bit of tuning to make sure that it actually did good all the time and didn't do any harm. Just completely a community effort, and you know, sort of when the community was saying this mostly does good and never seems to do harm, that's pretty much what Mike needed to put it into the kernel. So he took the community developed modules and rolled them into the BSD release.
So if you looked at the dates and you sort of connect the dates together, what Vint was talking about is like late 70s, early 80s, they considered TCP/IP kind of done. And now this is kind of mid 85, 86 time frame that Vint's talking about. And what happened sort of between those times is that's just how long it took for us to sort of like become addicted to the internet, right? So we had this thing where we were growing rapidly, and we didn't notice this problem for like 6 or 7 years. And we noticed it at the moment it was becoming popular. And at the moment it was becoming popular was when it crashed. And Vint like stepped in at the exact right time and fixed it. And that's why I give him a lot of credit of just, if he didn't solve this, it's entirely possible that, like many of the things we've talked about in this class, that you know it might not be here, right? We might be using an IBM or a digital equipment network instead. So the TCP layer is both simple and complex. It is simple in that its job is to retransmit and decide how much data to send and retransmit as necessary with timers and things like that. So it's really quite simple, but then there is a whole lot of subtlety. What's really interesting is that the Van Jacobsen protocols are in every one of your computers. And what your computer is programmed to do is actually be a little courteous when it's making use of the internet. If you could reach inside your computer and you had a knob to turn down the courtesy of your computer, so all the computers in this room and all the computers right now, all the Google servers, everything, they are all set up to be courteous and not overwhelm the internet. If one of your computers could be turned to be discourteous, the other computers would back out of its way because they're courteous. So one of your computers became a rude computer, you would get a lot more throughput as a rude computer. But everyone else would lose because everyone else's computer is programmed to be courteous. Of course, then once you figured out how to make your computer be a rude computer, someone else would like flip their computer to be rude. And the next thing you know, the computers would all be rude computers and the internet would crash. So that one of the things that keeps the internet alive is the code that Van wrote that's in all of your computers that makes sure that we don't crush it. We don't crush it. So it's still kind of a collective thing, and we don't want the computers to become rude computers, otherwise they would crush it. So this TCP layer is the first layer that thinks from one end of the system, one system all the way across the internet to the other system. IP moves packets, but basically when transport layer finishes, we're talking to the other end. So that's kind of nice. We call it a pipe or a socket. So I want to talk really briefly about the security, how security works. I know I'm going to run out of time. I always run out of time in this lecture. So everything that I just said is, if you watch the network and you can turn your Wi-Fi's into being in what's called promiscuous mode and watch all the packets go by, you could technically watch all the data, passwords, credit card numbers, everything. So for this to really scale, once it got out of the lab and in the real world, we want to do commerce on it, we need to come up with a security mechanism. So when you start thinking about security, you got to think about who the bad guys are and where they might attack the system. They could attack the system in this room in Wi-Fi. They could attack the wire. If you have a key to the built room, you could kind of hook yourself into the wire. If you're like in Kansas City, you can like pop the wire apart and put a little gadget in. There is a lot of places that your data could be pulled off. So we could have tried to secure each one of these things by making a law that said you have to have two locks on every door, right? Or we have to have top secret clearance to go into a backbone room. And those are all good reasons. But it turns out it's just pointless, because you can't make laws or make locks good enough. Sooner or later, there's going to be somebody that does something bad and gets a hold of your packets. So the network security that we came up with assumed that it was all insecure. Everything is insecure. This Wi-Fi is insecure. Just assume the wire going out of here is insecure. Everything. Kansas City is insecure. The bad guys can get at all of it. How would you build a security system if the bad guys can touch it all? So we call this thing transport layer security. You see it as HTTPS in your browser. So it uses a technology called public-private key encryption that is based on large prime numbers being multiplied together. So if I pick two prime numbers like 5 times 7, and I multiply them together and say 35, there's only two numbers that are the factors of 35. It's 5 and 7, right? There's only two factors. And if you get the big number, it takes you a little while to figure out what the two little numbers are. Well, what they do is they have like a prime number that's this big and another prime number that's this big, and they multiply it, and these are truly prime, and they make a number that's gigantically big. So, and this gigantically big number has exactly two factors, two numbers, you can't multiply any other, and it's really hard with a number this big to figure out what the exact two factors are. And so the numbers are used to encrypt and decrypt the data. But it turns out that it is breakable. It is breakable if you have enough time. You have to do lots and lots and lots and lots of calculations. And over the years, what we do is, as general purpose computers get faster, we have to make the numbers bigger. So we have a kind of approximation of how long it would take to break into your credit card by getting your packets. And they're pretty smart people, and these numbers are big enough so that sort of all the computers on this campus might take, you know, 2 days. If we could take all the computers on this campus and attack your computer, we could figure out what your credit card numbers were, if we could somehow use all those. Now, the interesting thing is that there are people that have a lot more computers than that, say, like the government, right? So they have lots of computers. They keep the best computers for themselves, and they give us kind of like the second best computers. And so it's entirely likely, and of course I have no information, so I'm not an expert on this, but it's entirely likely that the government has enough computing power to break into your secure connections. But they do not have enough computing power to break into every one of everybody's secure connection. So this is an example why something happens bad, you know, somebody does something criminal, and they like get caught on a little camera and they figure out who the person is, and like 2 days later, it seems as though the government knows everywhere that that person bought coffee for the past year and a half. You know, they know everything about them. And that's because they can decrypt everything once they know what to decrypt, right? They can't decrypt all of it because it's so computationally challenging to decrypt all of it. And this, again, why you don't want to be an international arms merchant and try to protect your stuff. Because if they know you're an international arms merchant, they're decrypting it probably all the time. So if you're boring, like most of us are totally boring, no one's going to look at our stuff. Now, the interesting thing, again, I'm not an expert, I don't know this, but it's entirely likely that they're recording almost all of it, encrypted, and then selectively unencrypting it. So you shouldn't assume that what you're doing is unencryptable if you're an international arms merchant. But if you're just like an MSI student with a lot of student debt, no one cares about you at all, and so no one's going to decrypt your stuff. So you might say, well, why don't we make a security protocol that's perfect? And the answer is, it hasn't been done yet. They're all imperfect. It's better to actually know what the imperfections are, bound the complexity of the breakage, rather than pretend it's perfect, because it's just not. So there was a couple of years ago, there was a big brouhaha on Facebook, because it takes a little more computation, both on your computer and the server computer, to do the secure protocol. And so some people with really a lot of servers, like Facebook, would send some of their data over the insecure protocol and some of the data across the secure protocol. Facebook used to make it so when you're logging in, they would use the secure protocol, but then when you're just kind of cruising through and seeing status updates, it would use the insecure protocol. But there was data being passed back and forth in the insecure protocol. After you logged in, it would set this thing called a cookie in your browser, and the cookie gets sent back across. That would be sent across insecure. And like 3 years ago, somebody made this really cool plugin for the browser where you could walk up to a Starbucks, and if you sat, you would start seeing all the people using Facebook. They would start popping up on your computer with their faces and everything, right? Because they weren't stealing your password, because that was protected from security, but they were stealing your cookie, which allowed them to go into your Facebook account. Now, if they logged out, that you couldn't do it. But it was very convenient, and anyone could use it, and that you could log in. I mean, you couldn't log in, you didn't steal the person's password, but you could post as them, and you could see their pages and see all their friends. And a lot of things that happen that fix security are when people get really, really embarrassed. And so this was really embarrassing, that the average person could download and install a piece of software on their Macintosh, walk into a Starbucks, wait 5 minutes, and start using other people's Facebook accounts. It was extremely convenient. So this is the kind of thing where, you know, if the security can be broken, someone will make it easy to break. So it's better to kind of bound it. Now, if you'll notice, everything you do at Facebook is now HTTPS, not HTTP. So we have this way of encrypting streams of data, and we're going to send it across a network that we consider dangerous. Everything in it is considered to be dangerous. So TCP/IP is kind of this end-to-end stream that sort of gets a stream of packets with reliable and retransmission and all that stuff. And what we do is we secure it inside your computer and send across the normal TCP an encrypted stream rather than an unencrypted stream. And so we encrypt the data inside your computer. It just wanders across the backbone encrypted, and it comes out and it's decrypted inside Amazon or your bank or Facebook or whatever. So the bad guys actually can record the encrypted data, maybe decrypt it later with large amounts of computing, but record the encrypted data. So they do. And you can imagine that the FBI or whatever has plugs into various places on the internet, so they get a lot of stuff. I mean, they can come and put a subpoena in and plug in and just draw all the stuff out. Now, they can't see into your secure stuff, but they can record the encrypted parts of your secure stuff. So with this, other than that kind of caveat that the government probably can break into it in little things, the caveat is that pretty much you're totally safe from somebody watching your packets in the middle, because you encrypt them with extremely strong encryption before you leave its computer, and it doesn't decrypt until it comes back in. That sounds great, except for one thing, and that is part of the secure protocol is you talk to Amazon and it gives you back a key to use to do your encryption. Now, if you talk to something that looks like Amazon that's not really Amazon, it will give you a key. You will encrypt your data, you will send it to not Amazon. Not Amazon will be able to decrypt it. No one else will be able to decrypt it. Amazon couldn't even decrypt it, right? This other evil Amazon is decrypting your data because it gave you the key to do the encryption. So the bad guy, if the bad guy can get you at the beginning, they hand you the key, you encrypt it, they decrypt it, you're completely secure from prying eyes, except you're talking to the wrong server. So this is a problem. So how do we solve this? Well, it turns out that they take these keys, which are little pieces of data, and they add a digital signature to them. And so if you are connected by HTTPS, you can look at the digital signature. So the key is signed by some third-party authority called a certificate authority. And your laptop, your computer, can see, A, there is a cert, this key that I've been given is signed by a third party, and you can verify that. These third parties are called certificate authorities. Certificate authorities are people that can sign keys. So Amazon is not a certificate authority. Amazon gets a key from a certificate authority that's signed, and then your computer verifies with that certificate authority that you're really talking to the real Amazon. So there's a number of different vendors of these. There are these third parties that verify these keys. One's called VeriSign. Another one's called Entrust. Now, I should probably put more slides in about this. So now we have a way to take the key from this Amazon and verify with a third party that it's really the Amazon been signed by this third party. But what happens if the third party is evil too? Right, so they give you a certificate and says, this is good according to Dr. Chuck's really trustable security service. You can call Dr. Chuck's really trustable security service and they'll say, yeah, that looks pretty good. So now we have another problem. Like, how do you trust these third-party security services? Like, this thing's like Mercury. Every time we're like, ah, we got it. So at some point, we've got to come up with something we trust so that we can sort of like create this chain of trust. And so it turns out that your computers, every one of them, come with a list of the trustable third parties. These are the trusted certificate authorities. So you can go and look deep in your computer and find out what certificate authorities your computer's operating system shipped with. So Microsoft, Apple, Linux, everybody, when they make an operating system, they put in that operating system a list of the truly trustable third-party certifiers. If the certificate from Amazon has been signed by one of the already trusted certifiers, your browser doesn't pop up a message. Your browser just says, hey, if it came from VeriSign, I know VeriSign, I'll check it, looks good to me. If this certificate says it's Amazon and it's signed by VeriSign, that's enough. So you'll just go to HTTPS, you'll come to it, and it'll just be good. You might go and you might see a pop-up that says, this certificate seems to be signed by an untrusted authority. That means the third party you're being directed to is not in the list that's already in your laptop. Actually, the most dangerous thing that you can do is there's another thing that pops up that says, would you like to add this new certificate authority to be one of your trusted certificate authorities? From that point on, you're like screwed, right? Because they've got the bad guy. Dr. Chuck's extremely secure certificate service has now been added to your operating system for all perpetuity. You can accept a certificate temporarily, but if you say I'll install a new certificate authority, you're like toastified, right? And so that's sort of how these all work. Now the interesting thing is, and I don't know if you can Google this anymore, you can probably Google like VeriSign is the devil. And you will find a bunch of really angry people because it turns out that this has been going on for a long time. And if you're Amazon and you don't want to have a pop-up dialogue every time you try to establish a secure connection, you pretty much have to buy your certificate from VeriSign because VeriSign was in the early versions of Windows, right? Some of these new ones have only been in the last couple of years. So if you want the best certificate that's most likely to be accepted without a pop-up, you pretty much have to go to VeriSign. So that means the VeriSign certificates are very valuable. It takes no effort on their part to manufacture these things. It's like, I'll send you an email and I'll send you an email back. But it can cost like $2,000 a year to have a certificate from VeriSign. It's because they're the ones that were baked into all the operating systems for the past 10 years, VeriSign turns this into a way to make money. Now, VeriSign does have some work it has to do. If VeriSign certificates are compromised, Apple will patch their operating system in a second and take VeriSign out. So I don't know of any real VeriSign compromises. So they must do work pretty hard to make sure their keys don't get compromised. Somewhere I read something about how they have this key on a USB stick and it's inside of a vault, It's got some thing that only like two people in the world know, blah, 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 blah. The thing that you would steal to the point where you could fake Amazon certificates. So there is some effort and due diligence to keep it so that trust stays in the operating system. Yeah?
I'm just a little confused about how the process works where if your computer goes to URL Amazon.com, why wouldn't it always go to the Amazon site? Because didn't they buy that URL?
No. So what they can do, there's all kinds of ways that they can mask it so you're going to a different site. I'll just give you one. The domain name system that turns www.amazon.com into an IP address can be compromised as well. So if I can send you to a bad guy's domain name system, you go like, hi, I'm off to amazon.com, and then it gives you back like 141.211 whatever, which is not amazon.com, but the bad guy server. That's not the most common one. The most common one is to do something in your user interface that just makes it look like you're at amazon.com. But the notion of the DNS one is kind of an obvious one. If I can corrupt your DNS, if I can reroute your DNS, then I gotcha. I can send you anywhere. You go to Facebook, I'll put up whatever address I want. Okay, so we have this sort of layer. The encryption, the decryption, it's in the server. The data comes down and it's encrypted before it leaves the server, decrypted on the way out in the server. Unencrypted data never leaves the system. We have these certificates that ensure that the far end that you're talking to is who you think that is. It all kind of works together, kind of nice. So now we have this sort of way to move data back and forth. And this brings us to the last layer, the application layer. The application layer is kind of the applications themselves, like web or email or file transfer, video playing, video streaming. These are all things that we're doing now that this whole lower three layers are in place. So we have sort of this pipe thing, right? This transport gives us a pipe. We send data in one, it comes out the other. And now it's done securely. So once we're in the application layer, are we going to do mail? Are we going to do the web? Are we going to do file transfer, stream video videos? What do we want to do? So computers can have multiple applications. There can be a web server on this computer, an email server on this computer, and a pop mail server on the computer. And so we need a way to sort of be able to figure out what application we want to talk to. And that's called ports. And then we have to figure out how we're going to talk to it. So ports are like a further refinement of IP address, pretty much like phone extensions. So IP address is the address of the network connection of a particular computer, but if that computer has multiple applications inside of it, we use ports to pick the application. So for example, this box over here is a computer, a server somewhere, and it's got an address of 74.208.28.177. But it's got all these servers on it. Incoming email comes on port 25. Logging into that computer goes to port 23. Unsecured HTTP web service comes on port 80. Secured comes on port 443. And mailbox comes on 109 or 110. There's actually four or five of these things. And so when you're making, your application is making a connection, it has to choose which port it talks to. And as we have built different applications, we assign these port numbers. You can kind of know the ones that are classic because they have lower numbers. And the more modern and more recent ones have higher numbers. But that's just another thing we write down, is where mail's supposed to be, where the web's supposed to be. We make something new and we make a new port number for it. So this is a way to have multiple applications at one IP address and have a way to sort of rotate, pick the thing that we're going to talk. But now we've got to talk to the application. We've made a connection, and now what do we say to that application, and what do we expect that application to say to us? So the application protocol that we'll look at next is the Hypertext Transport Protocol, HTTP, which is the protocol used to retrieve web documents on the web, invented by Tim Berners-Lee and Robert Caillou. It's a real simple protocol because they didn't want to make it too complex. So it's very simple. You make a connection, you send a request for a document, and then you wait and you get the document back, and away you go. This is called the request response cycle. Now we're talking about HTTP. We assume we have this pipe somewhere. So if I show you a web page, here is a web page. It's not much of a web page. So I'm running an application. So this thing here is a browser. It's a piece of software running on my Macintosh. It's on my Macintosh. It's showing me this page. If I look at the source of this, if you remember, I told Robert Caillou that I thought HTML was a glorious language. And he said, headers have fixed numbers. That's horrible. And then I said, you're right. just because I didn't want him to get mad at me. So there's headers and all that stuff, and that's HTML. That's the document that's been retrieved. So I'm looking at a document, and I'm like, what do I want to do? I'm going to like cruise around with my mouse. This is all on my laptop. Nothing's going on the network right now. And I like come across this. I'm like, I will click on this. That is a hypertext reference to another page. You can even see down here what the page is. So I haven't clicked yet, but when I click, I'm clicking on my laptop, and this application, Chrome, is going to spring into action and make a network connection to www.drchuck.com, and then it's going to say, give me this document, and then it gets a different document, and it's going to show the document. It's going to go really fast, of course. Bang, it just did that, right? I clicked it, it like goes, oh, you want something, I'll go get it for you. Hang on, let me make a connection here. I'll go this thing, give me back, thank you very much, and put it up, okay? The request response cycle. If I do it here, there's another request response cycle. There's another request response cycle. So if we were to slow this down a little bit, right, from here down is kind of my laptop, right? So I click, Chrome receives the click. In the background, Chrome makes a connection to the web server across the internet. This over here is the internet. Gets a document back that happens to be in the form of HTML. And then my browser, when it gets that document, it shows me a different page. So I was looking at this page, I did a click. A moment later, I looked at this page. But in the background, a round trip happened to a server. Oops. Now the command that gets sent to the server, let me fix this. The command that gets to the server is part of the HTTP protocol. And if you wanted to write a web browser, you would have to go get the document that would tell you how to write a web browser. Because there's lots of web browsers and they all seem to talk to all web servers. So there's rules for how to do it. You go to the same place. Find the RFC for the Hypertext Transport Protocol. And you see the top person there is Tim Berners-Lee. ITF does this as well. RFC 1945. So you can download that. It's like hundreds of pages. And if you read this slowly, if you read this enough, you could write a web browser. Question? Oh, okay. If you go down to section 5.1.2, it will tell you how the browser is to request a document. It says you're supposed to type get, followed by a URL, followed by http://1.0. Not lowercase get, uppercase get. So that's it. So it's telling you what to do. So we are going to hack it. So there's a command. Unfortunately, it used to be on Windows, but it's not on Windows anymore, called Telnet, which is make a TCP connection to a particular place, www.drchuck.com, port 80. So I tell it, I don't want to do a normal login. I want to connect to the web server. So I am now, I don't know where these servers are. It's like in Pennsylvania or something. I am now, whatever I type is being sent to the drchuck.com web server. So I'll say like, yo, web server, can I have page 1? I love you. Apparently it has no emotion and no sense of humor. The web server said, bad request. Your browser sent a request that this server could not understand. That's because I don't know the protocol. So luckily I read the 900 pages of document, and I know that I'm supposed to type capital G, capital E, capital T, followed by a single space, followed by the document I want. It's kind of redundant. I'm already connected to the web server, but I have to tell it the exact document I want. Then I have to say http://1.0, and that's from the slides. Right? So now I am speaking French to French people. So I typed enter, and now the server sent me back some tasty things. First it told me this 200 OK says, I like you. And 200 means that I successfully got you a page. Here's the date. This is the kind of server you're talking to. This is the last modified date of this particular file. whoa, I haven't changed that since December 2008. And how long it is and the kind of file it is. That's all metadata about this particular page. And then it actually shows me the page data, right? So I just created the world's like most trivial web browser. Well, so let's go get page two. So when you click on page two, it says get http://www.drchuck.com. Oh, yeah, I did. Bang. So now I got the second page. So this is what the browser is doing in the background when you're clicking. Yeah. You'd have to read the document. It turns out that the format of this command has changed from sort of the very, very beginning when Tim Berners-Lee did it. And No, it's not going to work. There's an earlier. The 1.0 means it's the later version. I don't have time, but it's a good question. It's a good question. It's a good question. And I don't have time. It's a good question. I try to figure out if I could say it in less than 5 minutes. I can't. Okay, so here is, you see it in slides. The purple bit there is me doing the telnet. The yellow is what I type, and the green is what comes back. And this is actually, it's minus the 1.0, and so the format is different. So look on this slide. Did I tell you about this?
Yeah.
I told you about my former student rewriting this? Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, this whole application layer is this pipe. You got this pipe, and you got to know what to talk back and forth. What are you going to say? What is it going to say? Okay, the security adds a layer to it. Let me show you a different protocol. I'm going to telnet to www.umich.edu, port 25 now. So if you saw it go flying by, port 25 is the mail server port. Okay, so I'm going to hack the mail server at University of Michigan now. Oh, it's not, sorry, it's not www.umich. Ah, well, let's do this. I can talk to umich.edu. I can talk to the UMich web server. Get http://www.umich.edu/http/1.0.
Zach, you said that Windows, you cannot use anymore?
You can. You have to install a telnet.
Okay.
It just doesn't come built. You absolutely just go find out and say, install TCP utilities in Windows. There's a million of them.
Okay.
So you can use Traceroute and telnet and all. And Windows XP, it used to come with it. And you just pop up a terminal and type it, but not, they took it out because they thought it was a security hole, which is kind of stupid. So you see, I actually got the entire Michigan web page. So now I'm going to, let's hack mail though. Get telnet to mail.umich.edu on port 25. Now, by going to 25, I'm selecting a different server application to talk to. So now the server says, oh, welcome. You're talking to the Jackknife server, ESMTP. SMTP is the name of the protocol, Simple Mail Transfer Protocol. And so now, if I know how to talk to the mail server, I can send mail. So this, in the early days, was a fun trick we used to play on each other. The way you declare who the mail is to is you say RCPT space TO, must be uppercase, CSEV. So that's it. I mean, this is the mail protocol. You go read the spec, and this is what mail servers are talking to each other in the background. And then you say mail from, and we always used to use god@heaven.com. And then you would type the word data, and then you would type the mail message in the following lines separated by a dot. Now, unfortunately, you see that 553? That 553 is an error message saying, I don't trust you, so I'm not taking mail from you. But like in 1978, we could all do this. In 1980, we would telnet to port 25, and we would all just like send mail to each other, you know, punking each other, right? So, mail from God, come to my office immediately, right? And people are like, whoa, what's up? We just, this is what nerds do. So they've added a bunch of security to this that makes it so I can't actually hack it. But I'm typing the things that would hack it, right? I could, in the early days when we didn't protect ourselves against this stuff, It was a lot more fun. But then, I mean, in the earliest days of the internet, like in the 80s, there were so many security holes in computers. But nobody did anything about it because the only people connected were like me and Van Jacobson and like, oh yeah, like I'm going to break into Van Jacobson's computer. Like, what good is that? He's a nice guy. Why would you do it? So he would have a computer on his desk full of security holes. I would have a computer on my desk full of security holes. Nobody break into any other computers. When like all the rest of the people showed up, it's like, whoa, maybe we should protect ourselves. So there was kind of a scary time as the 90s came along where we had really insecure computers. And we had to fix them really, really, really fast. They're much better now than they were. But the first, you may not, the Morris worm is one of the earliest kind of security breaches that sort of, it also kind of took the internet down for about 3 days, where it would use this mail protocol to sneak into computers and then zombieize them, and then it would go attack more. That's why it's called a worm, kind of worm its way through things. And this was like a big deal, and there's like on TV, and everyone's talking.
One question, what's the point of doing that? I mean, is anyone, I mean, the only reason I could understand is winning money. But
there is money. These days it's all money.
Yeah, how?
It's all money.
I don't understand it. How?
You can sell a zombieized computer. If I can infect your computer, I can sell access to your computer to somebody else on an hourly basis. There's markets for this stuff. There really is.
Even with that, with the worm? That's
well, the Morris worm was theoretically an experiment that escaped from the lab.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
So he ended up in jail. He ended up in jail for a little while. Then he got a really good job out of it. But so what happened was, is we're just sitting around. Everyone knows that computers are insecure. This Morris worm is kind of the first big thing that pops out, takes the whole internet down on television, terrifies the average citizen. So I walk into work. And one of my undergrads, the same one that worked on The Matrix, except that was when he was still an undergrad, right? And I walked up to him and I said, hey, do you know about the exploit that the Morris guy used to break into all the computers on the internet? He goes, yeah, of course. Typed it in, you know, just like I'm showing you, just typed it in. It's like, that's what it is. Debug, turn debug mode on. And it's always available on every computer. I'm like, so like, why don't we do this? Why did Morris do it for this? Like, everybody knows to do this. We just don't do it, right? It was this culture of campfire, right? We're all in this together and we're trying to make this thing work. Why do we waste time breaking into each other's computers? But then that Robert Morris worm then changed it to the point where he had to become defensive, which was a good thing. I mean, I'm not saying we should go back to having wide open computers. So, okay. I only got like 6 minutes left. Okay. So we just got done talking about sort of this layered architecture, how we break the problem down, and a lot of engineering, just hundreds of thousands of engineers have worked on each one of these things, years of evolution of each one of these things independently. We kind of lived to this point where it's become really sort of ubiquitous. The whole thing, you know, if you go back to, this is the World Wide Web hosts. This is the internet host. So in 69, when Vint Cerf was talking, it had four. The internet had four. And so now we're sitting, you know, well over a billion. This stops at 2010. And the interesting thing is really kind of from others. So 79, 80 is when Vint Cerf got done building TCP/IP. There was 188 computers on the internet. The 85, 86, 87 time frame when Van Jacobson fixed the thing that he was fixing, we had like 5,000 computers on the internet. Literally, the entire connection was 5,000 computers. And really, not much has been broken since then. I mean, there's a lot of fixes and improvements, but it's pretty amazing that, you know, we're at several billion now, and they really haven't had to tremendously re-architect it. There is IPv6, which is a bit of a re-architecting, just we're running out of address space. But it's pretty amazing that the last real giant bug clearly was kind of in the 86-87 time frame when there was only, you know, somewhere between 5 and 20,000 computers on the internet. In a way, the reason that it works, because it looks like this is kind of somebody trace routed a whole bunch of places and found new servers and tried to build a map of how it's all connected, and it almost starts to look like life itself, right? It's just this very living creature. And part of the reason that it's successful is it's very almost biological in nature. It's really never completely up. Right? It's not perfect. It's completely imperfect. What's more important about it is the fact that it can heal itself rather than the fact that it's perfect, right? So our bodies don't live in like a germ-free environment, right? We just have mechanisms to deal with germs because it'd be impossible to create a germ-free environment. And so that's kind of how you think of the internet, right? It's not possible to make this stuff perfect. But if you make it so that it heals itself every time anything is wrong, it's always healing itself continuously. It's always regenerating and healing itself continuously. So it's been said that it's kind of the largest single engineering effort created by mankind. And literally probably at least millions and millions of engineers have worked on effectively the one thing that is the internet. And so to sort of sum it all up, we started in the 40s where people sort of would type letters in on one keyboard and they would come out on a different keyboard. And that got people to want to be together and share stuff, and the rest of it sort of just kept happening, and it kept happening, and it kept happening, and we refused to sort of give up, no matter what it was that tried to stop making this thing that we call the internet. Oh, okay. Let me